If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board. Wild Will Erskine booking the guests. And the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard, here, Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. I guess, where do you want to start? Cell phone bans. Which, you know, this is interesting because, you know, there's been lots of chatter about school boards taking, social media companies to task and to court and such. And, you know, I find that fascinating when we can't even handle it at the classroom level. So, but, you know, I guess whatever sort of cause you want to chase. Just nice to educate the kids, but I digress. And I don't think this is hard to do. I really don't. And I've got kids that are 21 and 16. No, 21 and 17 this year. Don't quote me on that, but around there. So, they grew up with cell phones. That's all they know. They don't know any different. But the teacher has control over the classroom at the end of the day. And I don't know how many times I've talked to teachers who, you know, either they get it and they can control it or they absolutely can't. And, you know, I'm sure there's scenarios and examples of extremes on both sides, but you know, this to me doesn't seem like a problem that is insolvable. Like people say that, well, you can't take cell phones away from kids. Why can't you? I don't get that. You make a rule and that's the rule. What's the problem? And you know, anytime that the teacher says, okay, pull them out. Let's use this for an assignment or some research. I'm all for that. And that's what this is about as well. But there comes to a point when, you know, the kids, at least if they're daydreaming, they should be staring at the teacher and not down at their lap, with their thumbs a smoking. So, I'm not sure this is an issue. I've seen kids on hockey teams, you know, deal with this and nope, it's, you know, they go in the thing at the door. They don't come in the room. And I'm not sure why that isn't possible here with just some rules. I don't know. But the Ford government has announced it's introducing new limits on cell phone use in schools. Now, this is sort of more detail of what we had already talked and banning vaping devices in a move to reduce distractions in the classroom and improve the health of kids. Stephen Lecce, the education minister, said the province is implementing back to basics measures. Implemented in the fall, and he'll be joining us a little later on, that is some of the strongest measures in the country relating to restrictions on cell phone use and the banning of vaping in schools. Now, why would vaping be any different than smoking in schools? Again, it's not like we haven't been down this road before. Our government is introducing the toughest policy in Canada to tackle this issue by cracking down on cell phone uses during class time, as well as banning vaping in schools. When it comes to cell phones, our policy is out of sight and out of mind as we get students back to the basics of restoring focus, safety, and common sense back into Ontario schools. Part of the new plan, kids in kindergarten to grade 6 required to keep cell phones on silent, out of sight for the entire school day, unless they get explicit permission from the educator. Meanwhile, those in grade 7 and 8 will see cell phone use banned during class time. So I don't know. To me, I've had this discussion with you before, when we're sitting around the supper table, around the dinner table, it's, sorry, kids, phones down, phones down, phones down. And, you know, they're always trying to, you know, sneak it in or, you know, whatever. Or they'll eat really quickly and then go to the couch. Like, no, sit down. So, but it is possible. And, you know, quite the contrary, I've found it to be quite a great disciplinary tool over the course of my parenting. You know, they used to say, well, you got to spank kids. How can you not spank kids? How are they going to learn? Okay. if that's how you feel. But, you know, you can't take a cell phone away from somebody. You can't say, no, you can't do that. And I have found you take a cell phone away from a kid. It's like, you know, it's like you're depriving them of oxygen. You're going to do what? You're going to do what? I mean, I think it's the best way to discipline. Hey, all right, hand it over. And you start it at a young enough age. It sticks. And still is enforceable in our house today sometimes. So, yeah, I'm not sure why this continues to be a problem other than I think teachers are on theirs, or adults. Let me rephrase that. Adults are on theirs just as much as the kids. And if you're going to tell the kids to, you know, put the screen down and stare at faces at the dinner table, then you got to do the same thing as well. And again, as far as the vaping, I don't know. To me, that's like it's no different than smoking in class or smoking at school. It's not allowed, so vaping shouldn't be allowed. And, you know, again, I'm not sure that any of this affects the safety or what have you. But, you know, when you've got school boards that are suing social media companies, you know, demanding they do something about their contact or their content and how people access their information. And are we doing enough at the classroom level? And it's fascinating, but we'll talk about that coming up a little later on and get the whole lowdown of what's coming up and what we can expect with this cell phone ban moving forward. Well, look what we have here. A documentary that's highlighting the connection between exercise and mental health, coming to the Art Gallery in Burlington, May 6th, part of Mental Health Week 2024, as they host a screening of The Human Race Around the Bay, followed by a Q&A. Doors open 6:30, screening at 7, 1333 Lakeshore Road, the Art Gallery of Burlington. And guess who's involved in the project? Ted Michaels, mental health and wellness advocate, avid runner, radio personality, and owner of his own air fryer. Ted Michaels is here now. Ted, thanks for the time. How the heck are you?
Well, I forgot about the air fryer because I was so excited when I was using it, and then I kind of got away from it. But yeah, it's still on the shelf. It's still good to go. Everything's good.
Well, I'm surprised that they're even letting you out. You still get to roam the streets freely and all of that. So it's so great to have you on the air. But tell us what you've been doing for the last little while since you retired, and then we'll get to the doc.
Well, basically same thing, trying to get in shape and stay in shape and run and, working on a lot of mental health initiatives. We did a couple of fundraising concerts for the last couple of years and raised over $35,000 for CMHA Halton. And this year I thought, you know what, I want to do something different. So said Ted, segueing into the documentary, I kind of wanted to, as you know, Scott, I've been heavily involved in the Around the Bay and promoting mm-hmm. the Around the Bay and just kind of getting people to realize that, you know, this is a fun activity, but it also gets people in shape. So I got the idea. I talked to a friend of mine who's a documentary filmmaker, Mo Masudi from Motion Pictures, and I said, I got an idea. Now, people that know me usually know that when I say Ted's got an idea, they either scream and cower for, you know, putting their hands over their head, or they say we want to be involved. Mercifully, that was the latter of that. Mo said, I was looking for a project as well to take on, so we kind of combined forces and basically put the documentary together, and this will be the end result.
So obviously, exercise and mental health, I mean, they go hand in hand, and we all know anybody, even just going out for a walk, doing anything to get out, right. it's good for your body, it's good for the body, good for the soul, good for the mind. Right. Now, talk about combining that and the around the bay. So give us a synopsis. What's this about? What's it like?
Well,
what are we going to see?
We basically followed, and it's almost like, without giving away the whole thing, I talked to six or seven different people who are all doing the Bay Race for different reasons. Everybody's got a reason why they want to do it. They're doing it for somebody that's in the hospital. They're doing it for their own mental health. They're doing it, Scott, because I think you'll find as well, the more people that you talk to, my line is everybody's got something. Everybody's yeah. dealing with some sort of stress in their life or mental health issue, anxiety, depression, family members sick, and I say, and if somebody says that they're not, they're either incredibly lucky or they're not being truthful. So we kind of thought, let's follow these people as they do a little bit of training. We had really great conversations with all of them. And then it all culminates with them running in the Bay Race. Some did the 5, some did the entire 30. But that's kind of the thing is, what is your, if you will, what is your why? Why are you doing this? And everybody has a different story. Some of our guests that are in the documentary that will be there in the Q&A, some of the guests will probably surprise and maybe shock people with what they battled in their life.
Was it difficult to get people to participate, tell their story?
No, there were a lot of people initially that I reached out to, and they said absolutely. A lot of people were reticent at first, and they got to, you know, think about it, and that's fine. Not everybody wants to go public. Nobody wants to share their story. But I kind of had a list, if you will, of people we wanted to talk to. They were all very, very receptive to that, and we're also tying in the charity aspect as well. United Way of Hamilton and Halton and Brandt, they're supporting us as well. So we're talking with them about how they support mental health initiatives. This is a part of Mental Health Week, which starts next week. So Monday is the kickoff, and we have CMHA Halton. They're involved as well, obviously, as the people that I work very closely with. So it's a nice combination. What's gratifying for me, it's a combination of businesses coming in, charities coming in, people from all walks of life. And the end result is we're expecting a, I don't want to say sold out, because you can't say that, because the admission is free, but we're going to be at capacity. We needed a bigger room. We got it. We changed the date. We're set to go.
So as you go over the course of this, as you're making it and you're interviewing these various people and they're telling their stories, do you see a common thread? What do you learn from this when you hear all of their stories?
That everybody is going through something. Everybody's got crap in their life in varying degrees. As we say, you know, family members sick or dealing with kids or dealing with, you know, family members that maybe don't get. So everybody's got something, but everybody has to have a reason why they're doing this. Some people don't want to run. I totally get it. We kind of featured a little bit on how yoga can also help you get set and get over the mental health issues that, you know, people are feeling. It's basically just, you know, this is their story. Hopefully we inspire people to at least get up and, you know, as you say, start walking a little bit. You don't have to run the 5, you don't have to run the 30, just get up and get moving, and you'll see how, why, when everybody tells their story, people will go, I'm so glad that you had this person share this story, because now I know what they're going through.
Yeah, everyone's got one. Everyone's feeling it. You're not alone, yep. That's for sure. All right, Art Gallery of Burlington, May 6th, as part of Mental Health Week 2024, hosting a screening of The Human Race Around the Bay, 1333 Lakeshore Road. Screening starts at 7, doors open at 6:30. Ted Michaels, doing more than just hanging out with the air fryer people and making little... That's amazing, Ted. Good for you. Keep digging. And are you running more now?
Let's put it this way. We're working on the final edit of the documentary now, and we put out a promotional video earlier. It's butt ugly watching me run now, Scott.
I'm not sure it was ever.
I ran like a gazelle. Now it's like a hippo. It's like, get older, it's like, I can't quite do this anymore. But I still do, you know, I can't run as many days as I used to, because my knees are just...
Sure.
The body's starting to break down a bit, Scott. But
as long as you're out there doing it, and that's all that counts. And good luck with all of this, May 6th. And congratulations to you. Kudos to you. Ted Michaels with us, and join him May 6th, part of Mental Health Week, the screening of The Human Race Around the Bay at the Art Gallery of Burlington. Hey, Ted, thanks so much. Good luck with this, and be well.
All right. Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
We've been talking, for a few months now about the stink. In Stony Creek, the Ministry of the Environment has ordered GFL, the operators of the former Taro dump in Upper Stony Creek, to prioritize odor abatement. That sounds serious. Over anything else, including accepting new material at the site. It was an order issued April 10th by the ministry officer report. The material being accepted at the site is being piled higher than it is allowed to. Are things changing? What does this mean as far as the smell that is obviously annoying any residents or the residents around there? Let's bring in Kathleen Morrison, a resident near the landfill, and with us now. Kathleen, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm great, Scott. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me again.
So what are your thoughts on what's developed here? What are your thoughts?
I'm thrilled. One of our complaints that we actually spoke about in one of the shows that we did a few months ago was that GFL was building the height of the landfill well beyond what their levels were supposed to be. And they were getting away with that because they were kind of manipulating the words of their ECA that those heights were their final height. So they could do whatever they want until then. So I think that we're very thankful for Tamara, the one who stepped in and said, you know, like, I don't agree with that and we need to fix this. And now we're seeing this new order that that we should see some change soon.
Obviously started all around the odor coming out of the area is, or lowering the height of these piles. Does that change things significantly for you?
So the odor has gotten better. In January and February, we had a little bit of a rough patch where it was getting really bad again. The last month or so has not been that bad. And from what we're being told, Tamara has done a lot of investigating. She's been up here, you know, smelling what we're smelling. She believes that the majority of what we're smelling now is actually just the smell coming off the waste. And the higher those piles, the further it's blowing, the more we're going to smell it. So if we lower those piles and it's kept within the burns that are there, then we shouldn't be able to smell that as much either.
I remember way back when you were chatting, they were changing something, they were making adjustments to the site and such, and that was part of the reason why you were smelling what you what you were. Has it greatly or improved? You said it's not that bad. What is not that bad?
I mean, there are still days that it's kind of stinky. You know, you drive by it, or if you're, you know, at the dog park that's close by it. And unfortunately for the people who live directly beside it, they're still getting some smell, but it's not reaching, you know, several kilometers away and coming into people's homes and causing the problems that it was causing back in the summer.
So do you think this is something that has been resolved or it's just moving in the right direction?
I think it's too early to really say anything. We're all very concerned still about the summer and what's going to happen come the warmer weather. Is that smell going to come back? But them putting the orders to lower the literal mountain of garbage, I think it's going to make a difference. And I know that the community is quite thankful for that.
Does that mean they're processing less if they're lower?
I'm not sure what it's going to mean for them when it comes to how much waste they're going to be able to take, because they do have to start moving the stuff that they already have. So I don't know what it's going to do to them volume wise.
What about the future of this operation and where they are? What do you see happening in the future?
I mean, obviously, we'd like to see that at the end of this contract, it doesn't get extended any further. And maybe I'm being optimistic, but I think that our government probably will see how this last year has been, and I don't think they would be foolish enough to let it extend. And frankly, I don't think that GFL will be foolish enough to want it to extend. But it's, again, it's way too early. We want it gone. We want it closed.
What do you know what's involved in that? I mean, is it just a case of closing the doors or the gates or does cleanup have to be done after that? What do they have to do to sort of rehabilitate this area?
Well, I know that it has to be capped, pretty much like any other landfill. It's never going to be usable area again, right? But at least they can cover it up and it's not going to be this massive eyesore of garbage everywhere in the middle of people's homes. Like the height that it has grown to is, I can't believe that it got to this point.
And just the amount of residential moving into the area being built up, we certainly know the housing situation is, do you think it's just its time has come to move away from this?
I would hope so. It's now fully residential. This is no longer an area that there's not houses nearby. It is residential. And, you know, with all the studies that are done of the damage that people that happen from people being too close, living to a landfill, you know, it's people's health needs to come first. And we need this housing. So
are you surprised that this has moved? Because I remember at one point you weren't getting any answers at all.
You know, I am surprised. You know, our government's. So I know the city, you know, Brad Clark has been involved, and this impacts him as well. Same with Matt Francis. You know, they mm-hmm. have definitely been involved and they have definitely helped. But when it comes to the provincial government and what we were seeing from the MECP, we were feeling very disheartened. And Tamara, like I said, she really kept her word as to what she was going to do. And she was clearly working for what was right, not for where the money is.
So this sounds like it's good news. And even in regard to the future, obviously it's drawn lots of attention and certainly the residents have complained. Do you think that it's, and I asked you this, I guess, before, that its time is limited, that it will be eventually shut?
I do. I don't think that it's in the best interest of anybody, even the company itself, to prolong this too much further, right? I mean, maybe carry out the remainder of the contract, which I believe takes them to about 2029 or to a certain volume. But I don't think that it's in even their best interest. You know, they've referred to it as a tired landfill. So it's probably just going to be costing them more money if they keep it open beyond that point. But again, I mean, ultimately that comes down to them and our provincial government. And unfortunately, we have not seen much action from them. So we really won't know until it happens.
All right. Some action for the Ministry of the Environment on the GFL landfill and hopefully cleaner air for the residents in and around the area this summer. Kathleen Morrison, one of them who lives in the area. Kathleen, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Good luck.
Thank you, Scott. Have a good day.
Unless you've been under a rock, you'd know that we certainly have a housing crisis here in Canada and many solutions trying to be found in order to ease the stress. Hamilton set to go ahead with its vacant unit tax following a procedural vote by City Council last week. But Ward 7 Councillor Esther Paul has expressed concern that even after public outreach, there could be some confusion around this all. Esther Paul is with us now, Ward 7 Councillor, City of Hamilton. Esther, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing great. Thank you, Scott.
So, Esther, explain to people how this works. What's the objective here?
Okay. The objective, it looks good by saying, yeah, let's tax these houses that are not being used so that we can provide housing for the homeless or for the people that can't afford. And this is not very clear said because in 2020, I've been opposing this all the time. The reason is, first of all, the implementation of it is totally wrong, where the city, to start this process, have to spend $4.6 million plus $2.2 million every year. We hire 16 bylaw officers. Now, as a businesswoman as I was, I do not invest money until I know what my returns are going to be. And the city clearly, I'm pretty sure they do not know how many houses we have that are vacant and why they're vacant. I think we need to do the homework first, find out how many, and completely know why they're empty. I mean, some houses are dilapidated. They cannot be fixed, and they need to be torn down and rebuilt. And as a homeowner or someone that has an investment, it reduces investment incentive for people to invest on housing, you know, and impacts on property values as well. So to me, the implementation is wrong. To me, it does not really provide housing. How do we get more housing? We have to get the investors. We have to get the, you know, people that know how to build homes, how to be build affordable home for the home, for, not for the homeless, for people that need homes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the better way, not task more people. And you know what? Half of the people, honestly, the people that I talk to, they don't even know. They say, what's going on? What's going on? I have to fill a form every year, and bylaw wants me to make sure my income tax return as evidence that I own the home. They want a vehicle registration. There's so many questions. People do not want to fill out forms. How many people really go on the website and find out what they have to do? People are not aware of all this that's coming down.
You can see how, you know, when you've got a crisis such as housing, that, you know, projects like this, they sound good. But as you mentioned, is the investment that's needed to run such a program, hiring whoever, is it worth it? Because at the end of the day, as far as helping the housing stock, this would be like a drop in the bucket. Is it really worth the expense to get all of this done to make it happen?
Right. You know what? I think we look at Vancouver, and I always wonder why we always look at Vancouver. Those are investors that come from, you know, overseas, that come and invest on condos. This is not Hamilton. This is your daily person that works hard, that wants to invest in a home, and maybe at some point it's not, rented because he has to fix it, whatever. So this is not Vancouver. I think it's wrong. The implementation is wrong. And in my point of view, until we know, look what happened to Toronto. You know, the debacle there. People were charged and they didn't even know. I think they had, 1,600 people that were charged. They never filled out. So let's learn from what happened then. And they're changing the way they implement that. So to me, implementation is wrong. To me, that's not how we put the house market, getting people off the street or getting more houses. We have a better way to do it and not to tax people. So I will always vote no to that. And I have since 2020.
Where does this discussion go moving forward, Esther?
Well, the discussion goes that we're going to see what implementation, what happens the first year. I said that, you know, we're going to see where it lands. We're going to have to see the metrics, how much money was brought in. I don't want to wait 3, 4, 5 years to say, oh, we got a little bit of money. Matter of fact, by then, most people will not want to pay the tax, and they probably will fix their home or they have to. So to me, it's a waste of money. I think we had a better way of doing it. We needed to talk more about it before we implement it. It sounds good in the surface, doesn't it? Oh, yeah, we're going to get money from people that own properties. You know, they're sitting on it. Who would sit on a property nowadays with the market falling and the interest high, inflation high? Would you, as an investor, have a house and let it sit empty? No, I wouldn't anyway.
Esther Paul's with us, Ward 7 Councillor, City of Hamilton, talking about the vacant unit tax. And again, with all the effort it takes to run such a thing, is it worth it? Do we get the benefit out the other side? Esther, thanks for the time. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
Three peregrine chicks sighted by Falcon Watch cameras Saturday morning at the Sheraton Hotel, 18th floor ledge nest. This has been going on for 30 years. And man, the pictures are absolutely spectacular. Let's bring in Krista Jackson, Falcon Watch coordinator, and here now. Krista, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm good. How are you?
So far, so good. Krista, how long have you been involved with this in watching the Falcons?
I've been watching at least probably 10 years. Volunteering, I'd say 7, maybe 8 years. It's hard to keep track of them. They're just precious each year.
It's pretty exciting to see each year. It's just amazing, really, that this keeps happening over and over again. They keep coming back.
I don't tire of it. I think it's amazing with the technology, especially with the new camera that was so generously donated. You get such excellent views, and now we can see them in infrared, so we can see them during the night when the eggs hatch. And just to watch the progress and the development, it never gets old. It's so amazing to watch.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, the definition on the shots, like, I mean, you see the little feathers and everything in their head. I mean, my goodness, it's just amazing to watch. And how many chicks total over the course of the 30 years of doing this?
The exact number is escaping me, but it's got to be around 67.
Yeah.
So I think this year would probably push us right close to 70 or into 70. So we've had a lot of chicks successfully fledge from the nest here.
That's incredible. So the four eggs, three have hatched. Is that accurate to date? And we're still waiting for one more.
Yes. So we did start getting the first chick came on Friday, and they've been hatching over the weekend. So we are at three right now. The fourth egg, I did see a very good shot of the little guy earlier today. The egg has started to crack, but McKeever is still sitting on her. I've got it up on the computer screen here. So you can see some of the chicks where they're still getting kept warm. There was a clear view about, I don't know, a half hour ago when the feeding was. So you see the three chicks getting fed, and there's definitely the egg has started to crack, but it will take a little time. We did anticipate that the chick would hatch at some point today, just based on the fact that the egg was found in the nest 2 days after the last one. So we expected a bit of a delay for this one to start hatching.
So how long did it take for the mother to lay all four?
That was done over, I think it's roughly 2 days apart. So it was done, you know, over the 7 to 8 day kind of progress here.
That is incredible. So does this, and you're expecting a fourth, is that about average? Is that what you normally get?
Over the years, I would say the average is typically four. We have had less. We have had, not at our nest, we haven't had five, but there are nests where there are five. But four seems to be the average clutch size with the peregrine falcons.
Are you surprised that they keep coming back to this nest? I mean, is that common for them to come to areas, other buildings, other structures where they are year in and year out?
I'm not surprised at first I was, but once you start to get to know the falcon, they do seem to be very much orientated to one area. And when you get a location like this, they're high up. The building mimics nature, so it's very much like a cliff. They have an area that's kind of sectioned off, so they're well protected. The chicks are from being able to, like, they can't just fall out because of the brick ledge around. And the fact that there are plenty of pigeons around town, so there is an endless food source for them. So really, when you consider the amount of areas that they can mimic in the city, they can mimic in nature. It is a perfect place for them. So given that, it doesn't surprise me. And I think it's pretty well known. And that's why whenever we have the nest vacated, it's never like there's always another peregrine to take in, whether it's a male or a female that has left, whether they've died or there's been a territory battle. This nest has never been open. And I think it's just because it's the prime spot and there's so many good features about it.
So pigeons, that's primarily what we're having for lunch?
Yes, yes. When volunteers will frequently see pigeons getting dressed, ready to be fed to the chicks throughout the season. Definitely a favorite in this area. It's probably just, you know, a lot to do with it's the perfect size of bird for them. It's also very popular. They're easy to get. So there's not a lot of hunting involved. Like, they're... It's not like you're hunting a prey that can get away very easily. So
you're saying it's easy pickings for them.
It is for them, yes.
Have you seen one take a pigeon? That must be something.
I have, yes. It is. It's one of those. It's amazing to see. At the same time, I'm like, oh, poor pigeon. But it is a circle of life, so you kind of get over it. I think the only one that I really didn't like is when I was volunteering the one day, and as they were dressing the pigeon, and the feathers started coming down on you, so it was raining feathers. And I'm like, okay, that's a little too much for me.
Oh my! Well, like you said, the circle of life, and that's one of the prices I guess you pay to have them up 18 floors. Krista, another great year, and kudos to all those of you who watch this and monitor it for us and document it all for us. And congratulations on another great year, 30th year. That's pretty impressive.
Yes, it's amazing, and we couldn't do this without all the volunteers. The next volunteer orientation actually will be on Thursday, May 23rd. So if any of the listeners want to come out, details are on the website so they can sign up and they're more than welcome to attend.
And give us a website where we can see these.
It is, if you just Google Hamilton Falcon Watch, it's at falcons.hamiltonnature.org.
All right, Krista Jackson with us, Falcon Watch Coordinator, 18th floor, the Ledge Nest, 30 years, three more and a fourth on the way. Krista, thanks for the time. Good luck.
Thanks for having us. Take care.
Don't go away. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
We've talked about artificial intelligence a lot on this show, and the good, the bad, and the ugly, things that I guess it's great for, and other things that you just kind of scratch your head, and this might be one of them. Your artificial intelligence therapist is not your therapist. That's one takeaway from a new piece in the online publication, The Conversation, highlighting the dangers of relying on AI mental health chatbots. To talk more about all of this, Zoa Khwaja is with us, Master of Science student, Health Sciences, Simon Fraser University, co-author of the piece, and with us now. Zoa, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And on this topic as well, I think it's much needed that we have discussions around this.
Many have talked about what is the right situation, when is it not the right situation. Let's start with, how is AI used in the therapy setting? What is its role now? How are people using it?
That's a really good question. Currently, as of date, as far as my research goes, I don't think there is medical devices that use AI in this light, where it is used in conjunction with a therapist and it's used in a therapy settings. So the article that I wrote with my supervisor, it's alluding to these chatbots that you can actually find online, such as Wobot and Waysa. So these are actually not medical devices. They're not devices that have been approved by FDA or Health Canada. But a lot of the times, they are accessible due to the shortage of mental health care workers that we have today. And so a lot of youth and people could turn to these chatbots to seek that medical advice or therapeutic advice to ameliorate their health care conditions. And that's where we say that it should be used with caution, as a therapeutic misconception can occur when vulnerable populations are using these chatbots as a replacement to therapeutic care, when in reality, that's not what they can truly provide.
So is there a role for AI in this space, or is it, I mean, my goodness, one size certainly doesn't fit all here. Is there room for it in this?
Absolutely.
In mental health?
No. Yes, that's a great question. Again, there is definitely a space for it. And we really do call on to regulatory bodies to ensure that this can be used safely in these spaces and with in conjunction of therapists, with also having multiple stakeholders involved when such a chatbot is being designed and implemented as a medical device that can be regulated. In this space where these online chatbots are being marketed as therapeutic agents that can perform evidence-based cognitive therapy, that can be a little tricky because these can't be fully regulated as they're in an unregulated space. But when we are looking at medical devices that can be regulated, AI can provide a lot of support and help to overburden clinicians who are currently we have a shortage of, and AI is there for increasing efficiency in that way. And so there is definitely a space where they can help and provide our healthcare professionals. But again, done in a very cautious manner where we do have multiple stakeholders involved, including our users and patient populations, and seek their input as well when creating such technologies.
I could see how this would be a problem in the sense that how does the patient know they're getting a critical information? They're getting a critical piece of information as opposed to like a self-help kind of book thing. How do you know this is from a registered doctor who's trained in this area as opposed to just someone who's giving you their self-help opinion?
Are you alluding to the chatbot or?
How do you know if what you're consuming is actually from a regulated or from a doctor who knows what they're talking about or a company as opposed to someone who's just tapping into this industry?
Yes, that's so important to make sure that information is available to users, especially when they are seeking advice from these chatbots. For instance, if a clinician, there is a medical device that has been regulated, it has been approved, and a clinician, for instance, uses it in conjunction in their care and they refer to their patient, that can be done in a regulated manner where there's human intervention, there's oversight with this technology, how it's being used, what it's being related to the patient, how it can be used to help them as a self-help mechanism versus someone who just goes on the internet, can't access care, and now turns to these devices to seek medical help when these chatbots, and they're being marketed as these therapeutic agents. And then you're right, it can be very problematic in that sense.
So just like prescription drugs, I mean, is this something that should only be prescribed from somebody who is qualified to do so as opposed to just a weekend warrior who's going on the internet to find something that will help them?
That's a very good question. I wouldn't say I have the answer to that completely. I can see benefits to going on the internet and seeking advice. We're seeing it also with ChatGPT. People are asking ChatGPT for mental health advice. So these large language models as well. This piece is more to caution people who are doing that, going on the internet as well, to know that what they receive, it can't be taken as full form of therapeutic advice. And if they can, there's ways to definitely utilize these chatbots in a way where they can provide them with better self-help resources. So, for instance, connecting them to helplines,
right,
and referrals with therapists. There should be some form. I think the best way is to ensure that there is still some form of human intervention, as it just is not the same. It cannot be synonymous with traditional forms of therapy.
Well, and we also know with the situations around mental health, obviously, the more people you are in contact with, the healthier that is. So this sort of like defeats the purpose. I mean, you know, the whole idea of seeking counseling is to actually talk to somebody, not to have an AI prescription per se. Are we defeating the purpose here? Should we be face to face?
Absolutely. You have brought up actually a very important point that we also mentioned in the article about relational autonomy. Another detrimental impact that this chatbot can do is that you're right. Our help-seeking behaviors are based on how we make social connections, our social context, our social milieu, and how we make meaning with our interactions. And when it becomes very isolating and independent when we're seeking advice from a language model that's or any AI, generative AI that is based on training models, and it's not taking into account your social situation, your context, your interactions. It makes it very isolating, makes it inhibits the person to make autonomous decisions, as now they become over-reliant on these technologies. So face-to-face interaction, I would agree that it should not be completely eradicated, especially from therapy, where a lot of people who would be seeking therapy would be people with diminished autonomy already. So it's very important to, again, have regulations in place and ensure that they can access a therapist, and that if they resort to this technology, they're not completely revoking their ability to access traditional forms of therapy.
Zoa Khwaja is with us, Master of Science student with Health Sciences, Simon Fraser University, co-author of the piece, "Your Artificial Intelligence Therapist is Not Your Therapist, Interesting Take on AI." Zoa, thank you for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you so much. You as well.
This is interesting. A group of Canadian MPs and senators who belong to an international parliamentary alliance critical of the Chinese government say the U.S., the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, recently informed their organization that many in their ranks were targeted by hackers linked to Beijing. The Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China, which is co-chaired by a liberal and conservative MP, say the Canadian government never told them of this cyber attack, despite the FBI passing this information on back in 2022. To talk more about all of this, Stephen Chase is with us, senior parliamentary reporter for the Globe and Mail, and Here Now. Stephen, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Yes, glad to be here.
So, Stephen, when did the Canadian government even know about this? Or, like with CSIS, do they even read this information? Do they get this information?
Yes. The FBI has said to this organization of legislators, this organization of politicians around the world who try to coordinate responses to China, it told them that it told their governments back in 2022, and we've confirmed that. We've talked to the FBI ourselves. So 2022, governments around the world were informed that this body, the Interparliamentary Alliance on China, which is basically a bunch of people who are concerned about human rights and about China's national security, threatening national security measures and so on. They were told that these people were targeted and that their emails were hacked. And this, but that wasn't passed on to the actual MPs themselves. So they only find out last week when their organization was talking to the FBI, and they were a bit upset with the FBI. They said, "Why didn't you tell us?" And they said, "Oh, we told your government. It's not our job to talk to you directly. We're not allowed to talk to foreign politicians directly. It's supposed to go through your government."
This seems like the exact same issue that you were all writing about way back when with CSIS and the information not getting up the chain. What sort of relationship does the government have with FBI? Is it any different than they have with CSIS, which isn't the healthiest of relationships?
I don't know if the problem is the FBI's relationship with the Canadian government. The problem seems to be when information arrives in the Canadian government, it gets locked in a drawer somewhere and not shared with anyone. That's the problem we had last year. As you recall, last year we broke a story about how the Chinese government was targeting Michael Chong, the foreign affairs critic for the Conservative Party, because of his criticism of China. They were actually investigating his relatives in Hong Kong, trying to find leverage on him that they could use against him. And of course, this CSIS knew about this. The Security Intelligence Service knew about this in 2021, and they told the government. Reports went to five different people. But then they never told Michael Chong. And of course, so we, in fact, last year, the government was so embarrassed about this, they created a new directive that intelligence agencies should make every effort to talk to parliamentarians if they learn of threats of them. Now, in this case, which is a different case, which is, 18 parliamentarians in Ottawa who are part of this Interparliamentary Alliance on China, they weren't told either. So the system is not working. Some people are not telling people. If you know that Chinese hackers are trying to get into your personal email, into your work email, you're going to take extra precautions. It would have been helpful to know. And that's why today you had the spectacle of not just the Conservative Party, which is the opposition, getting up to criticize the government. You had liberal MPs as well. So this affects both parties.
Can the Prime Minister say I didn't get the information like he did before?
The Prime Minister's office is not saying anything. They're, in fact, avoiding answering the question, as is Public Safety Minister Dominic LeBlanc. We gave their office ample time yesterday to respond, and they gave us a non-answer. They didn't even address the questions. They haven't explained why they didn't inform parliamentarians. They haven't explained why they didn't, whether they asked the RCMP to investigate. They haven't explained whether they lodged a protest with China. We've had nothing from them. Zero explanation. And that continues to today. Again, the stonewalling on this one. I don't quite know what's going on.
Where does this go from here, Stephen?
Well, the MPs from, as you said, both parties, the Liberals and the Conservatives, stood up in the House today, and they're asking for hearings on the matter. First, they want the Speaker to rule on this being this constituting a breach of parliamentary privilege, basically an attack on their jobs as legislators. And they want hearings into the matter to determine why 18 parliamentarians weren't told that they were the target of hacking by China back in 2021.
Won't we find out that information from another inquiry if we just get to the bottom of that? Won't this explain it all? The fact that there doesn't seem to be too much interest in the intelligence that's floating around with this government.
There is a real problem with this government taking intelligence matters seriously and listening to the intelligence community, and briefings being briefed and information moving through the chain, which is sclerotic and seems to be jammed up. So I think we've got a first report for the Foreign Interference Inquiry, which has been going on since March. The first report is due at the end of the week, and I expect it's going to highlight the problems of people not talking to each other inside the government, of this not being taken seriously.
Wow. Stephen Chase with a senior parliamentary reporter for the Globe and Mail. The latest FBI tells parliamentarians they were targets of Chinese hackers in 2021. Our government, not so much. Stephen, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
You're welcome.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
We certainly know what affordability has been like and how it is a major concern of most Canadians right the way across the country, including food, housing, another big one. But a boycott targeting Loblaws is gaining momentum online. It's the latest sign of Canadians mounting frustration with the major grocers. Does this have any impact? Let's bring in Dr. Sylvain Charlebois, professor of food distribution and policy, director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie, and here now. Sylvain, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Very well. How about you, Scott?
So far, so good. Sylvain, how did this start, and do these work? I mean, I remember a while ago, years ago, doing this with gas pumps. You know, don't buy from this gas station, buy from that gas station. How did it start, and does it work?
So I think that group started back in November, and since then, it has grown. I think they have something like 58,000 members. So there's more attention given to them. Media has actually given that group some attention. And but do boycotts work? Well, sometimes they do if the logic is there. But in this case, God, I got to tell you, I do struggle to understand the logic behind the boycott, because the boycott only aims at one particular grocer. It is the largest. Loblaw actually has about 29% of the market share. It's not even a third. But when you look at food prices have actually gone up like everywhere, all grocers. And so you're aiming at a Canadian-owned control grocer when you have American grocers that are in the market here in Canada and not even mention at all. So I do struggle with the logic here.
Obviously, there seems to be a massive disconnect between the consumers and the grocers. And certainly we know what consumers are feeling. So what are what are consumers missing, and why are the grocers not selling that to them? Why are they not saying, well, you know, here's the issue, blah, 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 blah. Or do the grocers just say, well, it's the way it is. Who cares? I got to sell lettuce. I'm not caring about this. Is this even on the radar? Are they aware of it? Do they have these discussions? Are they concerned about people feeling this way?
Well, I mean, per bank, the CEO didn't comment today about the boycott. So obviously they are aware of what's going on. Is it going to change anything? I doubt. It may actually change some of the marketing that the company is going to employ. I mean, let's face it. I mean, some of the criticism is merited, to be honest. Loblaw's PR strategy has been really bad. They really haven't been able to read the room properly on many issues, including the Manulife disaster. There was a 50% discount on expiring food disaster as well. Mm-hmm. And now you're hearing about anti-theft measures that are not well received. I mean, I could go on and on and on. Loblaw's PR strategy has been awful. And so I do understand why people are upset with Loblaw specifically. But generally speaking, a lot of Canadians are angry. They're frustrated. They feel vulnerable. They don't feel protected all that well. So I can certainly sympathize with the people trying to boycott Loblaw. But at the end of the day, if you want change, you want to be effective and coherent. And if I were to give an advice to boycotters, it would probably be to boycott all big box stores and focus on independence and really support the independent grocers that rarely get any attention. And that could actually send a clear signal in terms of what's wrong. Because right now, the boycott, as far as I'm concerned, is missing the mark. It's really not tackling what I think is the real issue in the grocery industry. And that's really what's going on between suppliers and grocers. That's really where the problem is.
How do the grocers or Loblaw specifically change the narrative, or do they have to? Do they want to? Because at the end of the day, everybody's got to eat. Couldn't they be using this as a marketing strategy? Could they not be using this to their advantage? Okay, you're unhappy. Let's bend over backwards and see what we can do. Like, how can they turn this into a positive? Do they even have to?
They did try, Scott. If you remember last fall, they froze prices for three months. Do you remember that?
Yep.
So that was Loblaw's attempt to get some support from the public.
They normally do that anyway, don't they, Sylvain?
That's exactly right. So there wasn't any novelty to the approach, and Canadians actually saw that and they didn't appreciate it. I mean, at the bottom line, when you look at food prices, things are actually improving. Some verticals, some SKUs are actually cheaper now than last year because consumers are spending less at the grocery store, and grocers are really aggressive right now. So a boycott to me is about 2 or 3 months too late, because people will go to the grocery store and will realize there are some good deals out there at the end of the day. So, but again, I do think this particular movement is a missed opportunity. The boycotters should have invited Canadians to really truly understand what the problem is in the grocery industry, and it has nothing to do with gouging consumers, quote unquote. Loblaws is gouging, but not consumers. They're gouging suppliers, which really, in the end, pushes prices higher for consumers and suppresses competition overall. That needs to be addressed.
Are you surprised grocers aren't taking more advantage of this in the times we're in? And we remember we've talked about Dave Nichols and the whole President's Choice. They were good products, but at a discount when times were tough. Why would we not, or would they not, to try to change the narrative by going in that direction?
I'm not sure Loblaw has the right corporate culture anymore to do this, to be honest. I mean, we all know Galen Weston, and Galen Weston is a very smart man, but he's not the most likable guy. really out there. And that really has impacted the brand itself. There are other companies out there that I would say have a different culture, but they're not well known. My guess over time, with prices dropping, with food inflation dropping, my guess is that people will move on. But the fact remains, the problem between suppliers and grocers is there. It's been there for many years. It's been there for decades. It needs to be resolved by implementing a mandatory code of conduct. So if we can actually accomplish something out of this boycott, hopefully we'll see governments looking into this matter as quickly as possible.
Suppliers and the grocers, there's the conflict. Dr. Sylvain Charlebois with us, Professor of Food Distribution and Policy, Director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University. As always, Sylvain, thanks for the time. Be well.
Take care, Scott.
You might remember when we were chatting with Ron Foxcroft about the Sweet 16 and the finals down in Phoenix. He was talking about self-driving cars. So we saw a article on transport trucks, self-driving transport trucks. It's nothing new, but it's more and more is slowly becoming available on it as it advances. Ron Foxcroft, also from Fluke Transport, is this the way of the future? Let's ask Ron Foxcroft, Fox 40 World, creator of the Fox 40 Whistle, 40 Ways of the Fox, CEO of Fluke Transport. Let's not forget Order of Canada. He is here now. Ron, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Doing well, Scott, and I want to compliment you. That's right. It's slowly emerging. That's a very good adjective to describe self-driving trucks. Obviously, we are very conscious of protecting the environment at Fluke Transport, and we're all for going green and carbon neutral and so on. However, I will say this. It is slowly emerging. Electric trucks. We have talked to a well-known major truck manufacturing company, and they said before the technology is really perfected in electric trucks, it'll be 20 years. So by using common sense, before the technology is really advanced and perfected, you'd have to say, if electric trucks are going to take 20 years to perfect, it's probably going to take 25 years to protect the self-driving trucks. You made a really good point about being out in Phoenix, Arizona, and watching these self-driving cars. Scott, it's really frightening. It's surprising. It's scary to see these cars driving up to stoplights, three people in the car and no driver. It really did surprise me. The other thing, Scott, there's two other things. Number one, at our company, Fluke Transport, we hire drivers and we take great pride in hiring drivers, creating jobs, drivers having the benefits that good jobs provide to them, which is an income. They can buy their groceries, they can pay their rent, they can pay their shelter, they can provide their kids with a good education. We do not want to see the advent of driverless trucks eliminate jobs in our trucking industry, because that we do take great pride. However, I will say this, never say never, never say always. You know, there's technology advances, and I would have to say that driverless trucks will be with us when I retire, which is in 25 years. And Scott, by the way, you are invited.
Yeah.
The menu is hamburgers, hot dogs, and no speeches. So I would say that on a parallel to my retirement and possibly your retirement, unless you say something extraordinary and the CRTC wants to reprimand you, you're probably good with your high ratings for another 25 years.
So, I hope not. But listen, I know that Arizona is sort of at the cutting edge of all this, and they've opened up some laws and allowed this to happen. And you brought this up when you were down there, like physically, like actually seeing a driverless car with nobody in the driver's seat. So how much of that is actually actually going on down there? How experimental are they?
Very much so. I'll tell you, it was quite common to walk three blocks and see at least three or four driverless cars. And it really is a different experience to see that. Now, with driverless trucks, they will come. Like I say, I suggest that technology will be perfected and the infrastructure. Because remember, I explained to you, I drove around for 4 hours in Phoenix with an app that told me where all the power stations are. And when I went to them, they didn't exist. We found one after 4 hours, and it took 9 hours. You know, there's a quick charge and a long charge, and this one took 9 hours. So first things first, driverless trucks, EV trucks, you have to have the private infrastructure. Right. That takes investment. The other thing too, Scott, I want to really stress to your listeners, right now, the cost of a driverless truck, we can't pass, we can't get a return on our investment right now. We can't, we truck groceries. And please don't let your listeners blame the trucking companies for the high cost of groceries. It would be really, I would say almost impossible to get a return on the investment right now on a driverless truck because of the heavy cost of a driverless truck. We'd have to pass that along to the shipper for the tariffs. So it's very costly. You can't get a return on the investment. However, like I say, this major truck manufacturer said that the EV trucks technology will be perfected in 20 years. And using my calculation, it'll probably be 25 years. The other thing, Scott, probably be more common on long haul. It would be very difficult around the GTA to accept a driverless truck because, you know, we have terrible, I don't have to tell you this or your listeners, we have terrible gridlock between Niagara Falls and Toronto. And I'm not sure the general public, forget about our return on the investment, the general public are really ready to accept driverless trucks. However, I think in the United States, where there's a population of 400 million, they can make these things in masses. You know, you got to make in the masses to eat with the classes and use them for long haul.
Short so you're talking. You're talking about long haul, and I'm thinking, I didn't even think of that. I thought that these would probably be more useful, like, for example, in a shipping yard or a distribution yard where there's stuff, or like, for the example, where there's containers, where there's stuff going back and forth in a confined area. Can you see them working in that sort of environment as opposed to, say, necessarily out on the public roads?
Very, very so, because then you're being respectful. Driverless and EV combined, Scott, now you're being respectful for the environment. And, you know, when we come to work every day, very first thing that's paramount to us, to our drivers, is public safety. That is number one. So that technology being robotic and computerized, that has to be uppermost. It has to be deemed to be 1,000,000% safe, because in trucking, that's really ahead of return on the investment, keeping the public safe. So in that area that you just described, yes, you protect the environment, you save money, and you can probably get your return on the investment. I can always see, I can almost see it, though, being used in a straight long haul. Say if you were driving straight from here to Edmonton, Alberta, where there's less gridlock than there is in the GTA. Now, Scott, one last thing. Please use your influence with your large million people audience to help us solve the gridlock between Hamilton and Toronto.
Good luck with that. All right, good Ron luck. Foxcroft with CEO of Fluke Transport, talking about self-driving transport trucks. Ron says they're coming, but not till he retires, so that's about 100 years from now. Ron, thanks for the time. Good luck. Be well.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, I hope you're doing well.
I am well. How are you, Scott?
So far, so good. I was going to ask you something sports related. Leafs, you know, way back earlier on in the weekend in that terrible loss, and I should ask you for your prediction now. All right. And I'm not a big fan.
I told you I would give you my prediction after game three, did I not?
Yes, you
did. And we never talked about it. Well, here's my prediction. They're losing.
Okay, thanks. Thank you for that. You're not expecting them to come back tomorrow and then win the whole thing, the rest of it all, and then off they go.
I will predict that at the same time that I predict you and I are going to have giant afros by Saturday evening.
Well, you didn't have to be that descriptive, did you?
All right.
I'm watching, and I'm not a big fan of the coach because, to me, he just stands back and he lets his support staff do everything. I don't think he even speaks to the players that much other than his big star. And the other night we're watching this terrible game, and they're just getting annihilated. And the camera shoots to the bench, and you see young Sheldon lean down and start barking at Austin Matthews. And you can see Austin just looking straight ahead, getting angry. And then as soon as that's over, then Austin turns to his left or right and then starts barking at all the other players all the way down the line. And then Marner throws his gloves in defeat. And it's like, my God, does that not explain to this team from beginning to end right there? The coach doesn't speak to the guy throwing the gloves. Instead, he talks to the star, and it's up to the star to yell at the other players. I mean, this is a poop show. It really is.
Okay, so I didn't see Sheldon Keefe going after Austin Matthews. I saw him talking to him, but I didn't think that he was giving
it to
him.
Well, he leaned in, and then as soon as he finished, then Austin starts taking a strip off the other players. So he said something to ignite Austin to turn around and start taking it out on the others. And I'm like, where are you? What do you do? What do you do behind the bench to motivate these people and stop them from throwing their gloves and acting like a bunch of peewee players? And to me, it's lack of leadership. This guy does not own the room. And what we saw with him leaning into Austin, and then he turns and screams at the other players, and then it goes down the line until Buddy throws his gloves. It's like, to me, that explains the whole thing. That's exactly what's wrong with this team. Am I barking up the wrong tree here?
No, well, look, we won't get into whether it was Sheldon or whatever. I will agree with the one underlying point you make. This team, for years now, to me, has looked like they don't have anybody like Brad Marchand. They don't have anybody like either of the Tkachuk brothers. They don't have anybody. It's ironic to me that this team's motto is the passion that unites us all. And there's no team that seems to play with less passion.
They're brain dead. You look at them on the bench, they look brain dead. This reminds me of playing hockey in the minor recreational leagues in every town. And there's always one really good player on the team. And he just, you know, he's one of those guys that goes from end to end. He really doesn't pass, doesn't do much. To me, we got a whole team of those. We got like four or five of those guys, but they're all brain dead. Well, nobody, as you said, there is no Brad Marchand.
So Sheldon Keefe is a very generally pretty level guy. John Tavares, their captain, rarely shows much in the way of that passion that we're talking about, not out in public. Maybe in the dressing room he runs around and stamps his feet and does whatever else, but here's the thing. And you know, I've been listening over the last weekend, and those folks in Edmonton and Vancouver where things are going really well are really giving it to Leaf fans about, you know, how, oh, your team sucks. Everything. If the Leaf players had 1/15th the visible passion and caring about this as their fans did, they'd probably be fine. It's, you know, giving it to the fans of this team, to me, is the exact opposite of what's right. These fans have now been with this team living and dying for 56 years. You can't blame the fans. The fans are the best in hockey because any other fan base would have departed long ago and said, forget it. Instead, you've got the highest TV ratings, the highest ticket prices, the highest everything, and the least amount of any kind of success. And again, I go back to it. I look at this, and some days I think, you know, what might be a really interesting idea, not this year because I do think they're done, but we'll see. But what might be a really interesting idea some year is instead of the same coach before a playoff game coming in and giving the same talk for whatever it doesn't seem to be working, you know what you should do? Bring in one or two of the real diehard fans to come into the dressing room, and maybe they would show what this means to the players. Because one other thing, back at Maple Leaf Gardens, when the team played there, the players would have to walk through the fans. You know, they'd have to go out of the building to get to their car. They actually had some contact with the fan base. Now, if you're a player on this team, you really don't have to really come in contact with anybody. If you don't want to read the paper or look online or listen to the radio, whatever, you can pretty much, as a player, go through life living in a bubble, not you're just collecting your very, very lovely paycheck and not realizing how much this means to the people who are wearing your sweaters outside. There are, in most other places, that's very clear. And I'm just not sure. Again, it just seems to me unlikely that these guys understand what it means to their fans, because if they did, surely there would be more there to give, that they would say, if they're willing to stay up every night and spend hundreds, they're not making the money we are, they're spending hundreds of dollars to come watch us, surely we deserve to give them more. That's my thought on it.
All right, Scott Radley, coming up after the 6 o'clock news, read them in your Hamilton Spectator. Have a good one, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. Teacher Mr. Lowe, regarding the cell phone ban, a step in the right direction, says Mr. Lowe. Now it will need to be uniformly enforced. Remember, teachers, you are the CEO of your class. Students are not your friends. They are in your class to learn both the curriculum and proper behavior. Mr. Lowe, keep right, except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.